You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
So we will introduce specific and targeted legislation to fill this gap by providing the police with a temporary power to seize a passport at the border, during which time they'll be able to investigate the individual concerned.
UK Prime Minister David Cameron announces new measures to combat the threat of the Islamic State and its British volunteers. I'll be discussing that and the day's other top stories with journalist and commentator Samira Shackle and Nina Schick from Open Europe. We'll also be checking in with our correspondent in Rio. We'll meet the people behind an art gallery, which will, depending on whose side you take, do for Santander what the Guggenheim did for Bilbao, or spoil a perfectly agreeable sea view. And we'll review the latest exhibitions in Vienna. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, right now. A typically action-packed hour ahead of us, but before all that, Paul Osborne has the latest world news.
Pro-Russian rebels have made a series of advances in eastern Ukraine, with government forces pushed back from key locations. They withdrew from the airport in Luhansk after clashes through the night. Officials in Kiev say that almost 700 soldiers have been taken prisoner since the start of the rebel offensive. They say at the airport, Russian tanks attacked Ukrainian forces. Meanwhile, the NATO Secretary General, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, says this week's summit of the alliance's leaders will discuss ways to strengthen their collective defence.
We will ensure that the alliance remains ready, able, and willing to defend all allies against any attack. We will agree a readiness action plan to make NATO more agile than ever.
Acts of inhumanity have been committed on an unimaginable scale in Iraq, according to the UN Human Rights Council. It's been told Islamic State militants are behind a series of attacks on civilians, while Iraqi government forces are accused of the deliberate killing of prisoners. Iraq wants a panel sent to the country to investigate allegations that crimes against humanity have been committed in the north of the country. In Britain, the government has announced plans for new laws to deal with people travelling to Iraq and Syria to fight alongside extremists. Police will get the power to seize passports from suspected terrorists, and airlines will have to provide more information about passengers. The Prime Minister, David Cameron, has told MPs it was abhorrent to see British citizens fighting with militants.
We are proud to be an open, free and tolerant nation. But that tolerance must never be confused with a passive acceptance of cultures living separate lives or people behaving in ways that run completely counter to our values. Adhering to British values is not an option or a choice. It is a duty for all those who live in these islands. So we will stand up for our values. We will, in the end, defeat this extremism.
Fighting has resumed between Syrian government forces and rebels in the Golan Heights, where more than 40 UN peacekeepers were abducted last week. The Fijians are believed to be being held by the Al-Nusra Front, a group with links to Al-Qaeda. Rebels seized a crossing point between Syria and Israel last week. Officials in Libya say they have lost control of most government buildings in the capital, Tripoli. The militias, who've been fighting in the city for several months, have now seized most ministry buildings. The Libyan parliament has been moved to Tobruk, a city around 600 miles away, but a rival parliament in Tripoli is claiming legitimacy. Nigeria has confirmed another case of Ebola, the 16th in the country and the third in the oil hub of Port Harcourt. Around 200 people with Ebola-like symptoms are currently under surveillance. Nigeria's health minister Onyebuchi Kyoku says cases in Port Harcourt are linked to a doctor there.
Two other contacts of the late Port Harcourt doctor are symptomatic, but as at yesterday when they were tested, both of them were negative. But because they tested, they are asymptomatic, they are under quarantine.
Events in Poland have marked the 75th anniversary of the start of the Second World War. Germany invaded Poland on the 1st of September 1939, shelling a garrison at Gdansk. 2 days later, Britain and France declared war on Germany. The Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk laid a wreath earlier at a monument in a ceremony in Gdansk. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Op Londen, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europe,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. It is 1806 here in London, 1306 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, I have the journalist and commentator Samira Shackle and Nina Schick, the communications director at the Open Europe think tank. Welcome back to you both. We will start tonight here in the UK. Within the last couple of hours, Prime Minister David Cameron has been addressing the House of Commons about new measures intended to combat the potential threat of the Islamic State and specifically of the several hundred British citizens believed to be currently among them. Late last week as well, the UK government raised the terror threat level from substantial to severe, whatever that means. Let's hear a little now of what David Cameron had to say earlier.
Mr. Speaker, passports are not an automatic right. The Home Secretary already has the discretion to issue, revoke and refuse passports under the royal prerogative if there is reason to believe that people are planning to take part in terrorist-related activity. But when police suspect a traveller at the border, they're not currently able to apply for the royal prerogative and so only have limited stop and search powers. So we will introduce specific and targeted legislation to fill this gap by providing the police with a temporary power to seize a passport at the border, during which time they'll be able to investigate the individual concerned. This power would include appropriate safeguards and, of course, oversight arrangements.
David Cameron speaking earlier. Samira Shackle, I'll ask you first, is that likely to work, I guess, is the first and obvious question, or is this a government that wants to be seen to look like it's doing something?
I certainly come down on the sort of latter, latter of those two options, because I think it's just definitely worth remembering that we've got already the most broad-ranging anti-terror laws in Europe. There are a huge number of powers sort of there to deal already with terror suspects. And I think also that the question about passports specifically, this isn't entirely new. Last year, I think the Home Secretary stripped about 20 British citizens of passports, but those were dual nationals. But there is a huge question under international law about rendering people stateless if they don't have dual nationality. And that's, I think, why David Cameron's been quite cautious in the wording he's used today, because I think he and other senior politicians are quite concerned about being slapped down by the courts if they were to sort of bring in something that would essentially be illegal under international law. And I think that you can also sort of look historically to see the risks of that. I mean, because you can't legally render someone stateless, but you can legally sort of stop them from coming back in to the country temporarily. You can revoke the passports. But it's a question of whether that's really useful in the long term. If you look at kind of fighters from the Arab world who fought in the Afghan conflict in the 1980s, many of them were stripped of their citizenship and not allowed to return home. So they sort of all regrouped in Sudan and it led to Al-Qaeda forming. So it wasn't particularly useful there.
Nina Schick, is there I have been trying to figure this out all afternoon. Is there a distinction between if you remove someone's passport, you're not necessarily depriving them of citizenship, are you? And the British government has done this to stop football hooligans travelling abroad.
Yes, but I think Samira is right. I think that perhaps they're addressing much more the symptom rather than the root cause. Once people are radicalized, Cameron is saying that he wants to put them on de-radicalization programs, but how effective that's going to be remains to be seen. But indeed, the Muslim Council of Britain already came out saying that this is actually going to allow young people to feel more alienated and lean more towards radicalization. And there needs to be more outreach to the Muslim community rather than kind of doing these kind of measures, which kind of seem like an Orwellian police state almost.
But I guess to return, well, I'll put the root causes question to Samira first. Is there anything? I mean, I guess there's no government that can say in a situation like this, look, frankly, there's not really all that much we can do. But is the reality that in a population the size of Britain's, there are inevitably going to be a few hundred slightly dim, vainglorious young men who think going off to run around in a desert waving AK-47s is more fun than working in Carphone Warehouse?
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. And I think that we do have, as I said before, I mean, we've got a whole set of laws in place already to deal with that. I mean, it's hugely broad-ranging laws about surveillance and so on that you can do under the Terrorism Act. So I think that there are methods there. I think there's certainly an element of wanting to be seen to do something about this threat, which is supposedly huge. But I think also, you know, this is a subject I've sort of written about in the past and speaking to experts who are studying the flow of foreign fighters into Syria. A lot of them say that while many foreign fighters do join the most extreme groups, and that is something to worry about, there are actually a huge range of reasons that people go to Syria. People return with a huge range of experiences under their belts, and they don't all necessarily want to carry out acts of terrorism. So, I mean, in past conflicts, I think it's about 1 in 9 returnees from these sort of Muslim conflicts abroad will go on to carry out an attack. So that's it's significant, but it's still a minority. So I think that there are things you can do rather than sort of draconian prison sentences and stripping passports. There are other things you can do. You can sort of monitor people, these de-radicalisation programmes, as Nina mentioned, and so on. So I think I don't think it's particularly useful to sort of make big sweeping statements and tar everyone with the same brush.
Nina Schick, does David Cameron, and I guess any British government, also face the problem that, I guess, of a certain public scepticism about terror threats, these sort of like meaningless sounding razors from some versus substantial or vice versa, I forget which one it is. Plus, I guess, I think there's a certain ingrained blaseness of Londoners in particular. I mean, I can remember being astonished when I first came here in the early 1990s and evacuation orders were given at tube platforms because of suspected IRA bombs and everybody just rolled their eyes and stood there. Are the British in particular hard to convince about this kind of thing?
Perhaps, but I think that with the Islamic State, certainly there has been traction, not only in the UK, but across Europe. I mean, today, Angela Merkel also spoke in the Bundestag and she made a substantial statement about the Islamic State. And we have to remember that of the 3,000 European citizens which are supposedly fighting there now, it's not only UK citizens, but citizens from across Europe, which is why I think this has, you know, caused some traction in the media in Europe, because there are people from all over Europe kind of going there, although it is only 3,000.
Okay, well, let's turn now from an anticipated crisis to an actual one. Moscow still denies that so much as a Russian boot print has been placed on Ukrainian soil. Ukrainian forces attempting to defend key positions in Luhansk in the east of the country have retreated, however, after coming under attack from what they claim looked remarkably like a battalion of Russian armour. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko has accused Russia of direct and undisguised aggression. Russia's President Vladimir Putin thinks the political state of Ukraine's Russian-speaking regions should be discussed. A pleasant euphemism. Nina, I'll ask you first, are we getting anywhere near an end to this? By which I mean, are we now starting to see what Vladimir Putin's idea of victory looks like?
Well, Putin's already made two of the taboos that you don't do in post-war Europe, and that's sending his troops over the border, which we know is true, and also over the weekend referring to the nuclear power of Russia, saying we'd like to remind our allies that we're a nuclear power. So
in case anyone had forgotten.
Yeah, don't mess with us. I mean, basically, it seems as though Putin is following up with his ambition of destabilizing eastern Ukraine. Now, today only he was calling it Novorossiya, the eastern parts of Ukraine. And what the EU is going to do, basically, I think, is they're already drawing them up, amp up sanctions even further. But interestingly, the new foreign policy chief, Mogherini, already came out today saying that there will be no military defense. But we'll have to follow that NATO meeting later this week to see what NATO has to say about that.
We'll be discussing what Mogherini may bring to the EU's foreign policy making in a moment. Samira, is it now, because it now looks to me at least like there is an increasing resemblance in Ukraine to what is already the case in Georgia and to a slightly lesser extent in Moldova. There's this semi-frozen state of conflict with these immovable Russian enclaves which allow Russia basically to meddle as much or as little as they see fit.
Oh, well, that's what it sort of seems to be moving towards. I mean, the peace talks that are getting underway in Belarus today, which included Russian separatists, that they're not asking now necessarily for separation. They're asking for greater regional powers and to be recognised as Russian language, to be given Russian language status, which would essentially establish them as, it's a sort of compromise perhaps for Moscow, it would establish them as enclaves in which Russia enjoys a lot of influence without perhaps going through the rigmarole of splitting up the country further. But as Nina was saying, I think the question of international sort of interference, or sort of following on from what Nina was saying, is complicated by the fact that no one quite knows what to call it, because as we've seen, that there is evidence that Russian troops have crossed the border, and yet they're continually saying we're never going to intervene. So it sort of makes the question of response quite difficult, I think.
Is there anything the EU can still do, Nina? There has been talk of more sanctions being imposed, maybe banning Europeans from buying Russian bonds. But if the fairly punishing sanctions that Russia have already been subjected to haven't altered their behaviour, is anything else going to?
Well, Russia's shown resilience in the face of the sanctions, but they are taking effect. I mean, there have been leaked documents from the Russian Central Bank detailing just how those sanctions are squeezing the Russian economy. Most of the effects are indirect. We're seeing lots of capital flight from Russia. And the EU can do more, so they can just extend those sanctions that they've already taken. That's squeezing Russian firms from accessing capital in Western markets and, you know, putting more people on, giving them visa bans and freezing their assets. But energy sanctions, which are the ones would have the biggest bite, that's always going to be the last resort. You know, that's not on the table yet. But as we've seen from Russia, they'll probably retaliate with tit-for-tat sanctions. They've already been saying that if the EU extends their sanctions, they're going to retaliate. And that's, of course, been squeezing the EU economy as well.
Samira, does it look to you, I guess, to go back to where we came in with this discussion, like, and I'm trying to be hopeful here, like the worst of this crisis may be over, that the real threat which people have discussed of a genuine full-scale punch-up between Ukraine and Russia is receding?
I think it's really difficult to say, because it just, the conflict sort of just keeps rolling on, and there's more and more signs of, if you think about the death toll, 2,600 people dead since April, I mean, I'd like to hope that the worst of it's over, but I think it's quite difficult to say that one way or another. I mean, there certainly remains a huge amount of anxiety in nearby states, other Baltic states, about this conflict going on and on. So I think it's been so unpredictable thus far, it's quite difficult to say that there's certainly an end in sight.
Because I speak as someone myself who has called this 100%, 180 degrees flat wrong at absolutely every juncture. I've spent now months myself sitting in this chair thinking this really isn't going to amount to anything. And it still is. Should I start worrying?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I don't see a clear end in sight, because throughout the crisis, Russia's kept on advancing, and the EU's red line has kept moving back. You know, it started with Crimea. And then, interestingly, as the Ukrainian forces were making significant advances in eastern Ukraine, that's when the Russian army went in, and now the Ukrainian troops are being fought back. So I think Putin's kind of dedicated himself to this, and I think his ultimate goal of more autonomy or a Russian satellite state in eastern Ukraine is something that he's going to go down fighting for.
On that happy note, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Samira Shackle and Nina Schick. When we return, we'll be looking at those protests in Pakistan and the reshuffling of the EU's top table.
Spirit, love, energy and culture. To be quickly accessible, unreroute the river, let the damned water be. There's some people down the way that's thirsty, so let the liquid spirit free.
The weekly culture show on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you didn't know you wanted to get to know, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, 1820 in London. Still with me are Samira Shackle and Nina Schick. We'll look now at Pakistan, where Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif is on the verge of going 0-3 in his attempt to serve a complete first term. In 1993, the army forced him out. In 1999, the army threw him out. Right now, he's besieged politically and literally by protesters led by turbulent cleric Tahir ul-Qadri and former cricketer Imran Khan. At least three people have died in Islamabad as demonstrations turned violent and the state broadcaster PTV was briefly taken off the air when crowds stormed its headquarters. Samira, I'll come to you first, Pakistan being one of your specialisms. Can Sharif survive this?
I think that he certainly can survive it, but it's a question of under what terms he survives it. So I think his premiership may well continue, but I think it will be a case of his powers being quite severely curtailed, perhaps, by the military. I mean, as when anything happens in Pakistan, people suspect the hand of the military behind it, and there's some suspicion that, that the military has been at least, that the protests wouldn't have been able to continue so long were there not some level of support from the military. Now, I think there doesn't seem to be much appetite among the military to actually take over the country again. I mean, bearing in mind that Pakistan's been under military rule for half of its history. This could well be a very good opportunity for them to sort of stage perhaps a soft coup, leaving Nawaz Sharif in power, but taking back some quite control of sort of key policy areas. I mean, Nawaz Sharif appointed himself foreign minister as well as being prime minister. So that means he's been able to pursue some policies which the military don't like, such as sort of rapprochement with India, pledging to stay out of Afghan affairs and pursuing the trial of Pervez Musharraf, the former army leader and who staged the last coup, kicked him out last time. So I think while he might stay in office, he's certainly going to be restricted on those key areas.
Because the thing, just staying with you, Samira, the thing I don't entirely understand about this is I can see that there may be any number of reservations people may have about Nawaz Sharif, but from the point of view of the people demonstrating against him, why not just vote him out at the next election? What's the hurry?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question, isn't it? And nothing in Pakistani politics is ever that clear, basically. But I think that, yeah, there's certainly a question of why now. I mean, Imran Khan, who's one of the protest leaders, his central argument has been that there was huge-scale vote rigging in the last election. Now, there's a question, why has he chosen to do that now, a year after the election? I mean, there's also the point that no local or international observer supports this this allegation, so I'm not sure where he's got it from. There were irregularities, but no one thinks it was enough to have changed the overall result. So there certainly is that question of why it's happened, but it seems in this case to have been sort of various stars have aligned that Qadri was staging his protest, Khan sort of got in on the act, and I think both leaders of their protest movements have backed themselves into a corner. I mean, for the last weeks, you've had Imran Khan issuing ultimatums. He said he'd have 1 million people out on the streets. In fact, I think it's rarely topped more than 20,000. And yet he keeps saying it's a revolution. We're not going to back down until you step down. And so I think he's just sort of keeps pushing it further and further. I mean, they stormed the area that they said they weren't going to storm. That's the red zone, the highly secure area. Security forces were deliberately not violent. So then the protesters sort of armed themselves with rudimentary weapons, you know, sort of baseball bats and so on. And it's sort of been a continual provocation, I think, for this end goal.
Nina Schick, Imran Khan, as Samira mentioned there, is possibly prone to the occasional vainglorious outburst. He's been reported as saying in the last couple of days, "I'm prepared to die here. I am here until my last breath." Is this helping?
Well, he's certainly very charismatic in his political style, isn't he? I think that's quite typical of the way that he conducts politics. But I think that the interesting thing now for Sharif will be to see if he orders paramilitary troops to shoot to protect the National Assembly, which will be meeting tomorrow. And if he does that, he, of course, risks dissolving peace. And like Samira correctly pointed out, if he calls for new elections, he risks dissolving his power base. So we'll have to wait and see.
I guess there remains the interesting question of what the army actually do if he gives them any orders. We should move finally, while we still have time, to a somewhat less volatile polity. Two of the EU's top jobs were filled over the weekend, which listeners may have missed, as it's not like there was an election or anything. Poland's Prime Minister Donald Tusk becomes the European Council President, and Italy's Foreign Minister Federica Mogherini becomes the EU's High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy. Nina, I'll ask you first, are either either of these appointments surprising?
Well, the interesting thing when it comes to the EU top jobs is that there's always a whole range of interests that have to be catered to, so that those jobs need to be divided amongst the old and new member states, amongst the states that have the euro, that don't have the euro. There needs to be a suitable balance of women v men. And the Eastern and Baltic countries were very opposed to Mogherini taking the high rep position because Italy has been very dovish on Russia throughout the Ukraine crisis. But that's kind of been balanced with Tusk being appointed the council president. So those whole very particular EU dynamics at their best have come out here. Interestingly, Tusk's position is probably the more influential one because as the council president, he's going to be presiding over the meeting of EU leaders where they make very important decisions on treaty change to the budget. Whereas Mogherini, even though the high rep position gets a lot of she gets a lot of exposure as a foreign policy chief, she doesn't actually have that much power because it's still essentially a national competence. What that means is that each EU member state has a veto when it comes to foreign policy. Although, given the Russia crisis, Ukraine crisis, perhaps she will be, perhaps she'll be a little bit more elevated than her predecessor.
Samir, I'll ask you as well, because as I said, these people are not actually elected by any of us or anything. Which, my own personal theory, this is partly the reason for, I guess, a certain engagement deficit that the EU has in Britain in particular. What do Donald Tusk or Mogherini or anybody else in those positions need to do to get more actual European citizens to care about what the EU does?
I think it's that's a sort of question that is posed across Brussels, or perhaps should be more. I think the fact that it is very difficult to get engagement with EU institutions because they're seen as quite distant, quite bureaucratic. And I mean, I think if you look generally at levels of engagement with even domestic politics, it's not great. So to, I mean, we've had some really low turnouts in elections, local and general elections in recent years in the UK, certainly. So to then have that next level of engagement which is with politics, which is still one step further removed, is quite difficult. But I think it is an area of concern. If you look at the Herman Van Rompuy, the outgoing European Commission president, has listed among one of the sort of three big issues that we'll be facing Donald Tusk as one of them is what Britain's role in the EU will be. So that sort of withdrawal of Britain and attempts by David Cameron and members of his party to rebalance that relationship and talking about a referendum and so on certainly is an issue of concern. I think it's something that's going to get bigger and bigger.
Nina, I wanted to ask you about Mogherini in particular. She's only 41. She's only been Italy's foreign minister since February. You mentioned there that the balance of interests and the certain amount of horse trading that goes on. It has been noted that some more established and, well, to be frank, more male names were thought to be in the running for that job, among them Carl Bildt, Radek Sikorski. Why would she have been chosen? Was it just to balance the gender role at the top table, or were there... Who else would have been in favour of her and why?
That was definitely a consideration. She's come out fighting against these claims that, you know, she doesn't have enough experience. But it's primarily to do with Matteo Renzi, who's the new Prime Minister of Italy. He lobbied very hard for Italy to get this position. And it seems that France was willing and the other countries were willing. I mean, France is gunning for a key economic portfolio in the new commission. There's more job announcement that need to be made. And certainly the fact that she was a female candidate did help. I mean, the commission president, Juncker, has been saying consistently throughout this process that not enough women have been nominated. And indeed, the European Parliament still has the power to reject the new commission and the new appointments if they feel that the balance isn't struck.
Well, she's not going to be struck for things to deal with. She faces a very, very full in tray. But I guess I'll ask you both each very briefly before we finish. What is the first thing that Donald Tusk, especially the incoming president, needs to do?
Nina?
So, I mean, I think so Tusk is obviously going to negotiate with the EU leaders, and the big things that are coming up now are immediately is going to be the Ukraine crisis. We'll have to see what Europe's energy supply is going to be doing. And down the line, it's going to be about reforming the EU, keeping especially Britain in, because Britain is going to be a key player in the EU. And Tusk, interestingly, got the backing of David Cameron for the position, and he said that he's willing to work with Britain to make some reforms in Europe to keep the UK in. We only need to look at the economic data emerging from the still struggling Eurozone to see that things aren't looking too bright. We're facing lots of geopolitical problems. So, I mean, Europe has a tough time ahead.
Yeah, exactly. I think that there's, if you're talking about the first things to do, there's the immediate crises. There's the Ukraine crisis, obviously. And I think other than that, it's the more sort of existential questions about what it means, what the relationship is between Brussels and the various member states, whether that's in terms of Britain's relationship or whether it's in terms of the Eurozone and what that means going forward.
We will have to leave it there at 18:30 here in London. Samira Shackle and Nina Schick, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still ahead in the second half of today's installment of Midori House. We'll be in Rio to hear why President Dilma Rousseff is now struggling in the polls. And we'll look at a new addition to the architectural and cultural landscape of Spain. But ahead of all that, Paul Osborne has the headlines.
Pro-Russian rebels have made a series of advances in the east of Ukraine. Ukrainian government forces have been pushed back from key locations, withdrawing from the airport in Luhansk after clashes through the night. Officials in Kiev say that almost 700 soldiers have been taken prisoner since the start of the rebel offensive. Acts of inhumanity have been committed in Iraq on an unimaginable scale, according to the UN Human Rights Council. A meeting has been told that Islamic State militants are behind a series of attacks on civilians, and Iraqi government forces are accused of the deliberate killing of prisoners. The British government's announced plans for new laws to deal with people travelling to Iraq and Syria to fight alongside extremists. Police will be given the power to seize passports from suspected terrorists, and airlines will have to provide more information about passengers. And officials in Libya say they've now lost control of most government buildings in Tripoli. Militias have been fighting around the city for months, have seized most ministries. The Libyan parliament's been moved 600 miles away to the city of Tobruk. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Paul. Welcome back to Midori House. You're listening to Monocle 24. It's 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 in London, 14:32 in Rio, and that's where we're heading now. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Joining me now is our woman in Rio de Janeiro, Sheena Rossiter. Sheena, welcome to the show. First up, Brazil's economy. This is pretty much the last thing you want to hear while you're running for president, as Dilma Rousseff now is, having just spent $11 billion on a World Cup and got beaten 7-1 in the final. What has happened and why?
Hi there. Yes, so it was announced on Friday that Brazil's economy has shrunk 0.6% in the second quarter of 2014, which makes it the second quarter in a row that Brazil's economy has shrunk, having shrunk as well 0.2% GDP in the first quarter of this year as well. So since that's two consecutive quarters, Brazil has officially entered a recession, which of course is certainly not a good sign for the current president, Dilma Rousseff, who will be running for re-election for her second term on October 5th. With about a month to go, of course, the other candidates are definitely playing on this, and especially since when she entered into office in 2010, Brazil's economy was booming. It was one of the few success stories having survived the global economic crisis. And actually, in 2010, the Brazilian economy grew 7.5%, which was the highest rate in 24 years when her predecessor, Lula, left office after serving two terms. And now Brazil is at a very low moment, which she will definitely be struggling against that as she inches closer to her reelection.
Is she, I mean, are people holding her personally responsible for it, though? I mean, there's only so much difference one person can make to an economy the size of Brazil's.
People are definitely, of course, there are various factors that makes the world go round, and definitely it makes an economy, especially one the size of Brazil, which is one of the largest economies in the world. There's definitely several factors that make that economy run. But of course, she is being partly to blame, and it is severely hurting her image since her more left-leaning policies are being blamed on the country's poor economy, namely the fact that she hasn't managed to get inflation under control. It's above the rates in which the Brazil Central Bank sets, which is 4.5% plus or minus 2%. And her interest rates have soared over 6.5%, as high as even 7%, or sorry, inflation rates have soared over 7% while she's been in office here. So with rising prices and with less international investment in Brazil, these factors have definitely helped lead to this recession that Brazil has just entered into.
They're also helping, or at least can't be hurting, the polling of Marina Silva, now her principal opponent in the presidential election following the death of Eduardo Campos. Marina Silva is gaining. Is it just because things are going badly for President Rousseff, or has Marina Silva seemed to be doing things right as well?
Well, Marina Silva did have a very popular image during the last election in which she finished third place. She didn't manage to make it to the runoff vote, and which obviously Dilma Rousseff managed to win back in 2010. However, this is definitely helping Marina Silva's image. All the other candidates against Dilma Rousseff are definitely playing on the fact that the economy has since entered into a recession. So, of course, what Marina Silva is playing on is her green factors, because she was the former environmental minister of Brazil, and she is very much for environmental rights. So she's playing more on those factors as well, but she also has learned various tactics from Eduardo Campos, who was the presidential candidate until he passed away a few weeks ago in a plane crash. When she took over that party, she's basically also combining her own policies in which she had before with Eduardo Campos' policies, so kind of combining the left to the right, if you will, to basically attract more voters. So yes, she is definitely attracting a lot more attention and leaving the other candidate, Eitio Neves, who was the former governor of Minas Gerais. She's leaving him kind of out of the picture, who was, before Eduardo Campos' death, he was the chance to get to second place.
Okay, I want to move along now to the Sao Paulo Biennale, which has opened up, as I believe, an unlikely new front line in the Israel-Palestine conflict.
Yes, this is actually a very kind of interesting fusion between culture and politics here. So basically, several artists from the Sao Paulo Biennale, they have written an open letter to some of the curators and basically the people in charge of the Biennale, saying, do not accept funding from the Israeli consulate in Sao Paulo. So far, the Israeli consulate has appeared as a sponsor on the sponsor's poster, basically implying that they are accepting funding from this. Of course, 55 of these 68 participants or collectives have signed this open letter, saying that this undermines their work while whitewashing Israelis' ongoing aggression and violation of international law and human rights. Of course, there hasn't been a firm answer from the curators and those who are running the show, basically just saying that they will reconsider it and see and have a bigger look at the matter.
Okay, finally then, and slightly more heartwarmingly, I guess, most stories about interactions between Rio's police and the occupants of the favelas are not good news stories, but I believe there is an exception to prove the rule.
Yes, this is a very heartwarming story that was actually picked up not just by local press here, by international press, and these images were kind of shown around the world. In a favela here in the south zone of Rio de Janeiro, in Santa Marta favela, basically, these police units, the unified pacified police units, the UPP, they treated these young girls who were celebrating their 15th birthday, which in Brazil and other Latin American countries if a woman celebrates her 15th birthday, that's when she goes in a transformation from being a girl to being a woman. So what did these police officers do? Well, they basically primped all these girls up and treated them to a lovely ball in Copacabana. And instead of getting brought there in a limo, these girls got brought there in police cars as they got to dress up in nice evening ball gowns with their hair and makeup all done quite nicely while they got dropped off at the ball, so to speak. So it was a very heartwarming, very interesting picture of these girls getting walking out of police cars while dressed head to toe in a Cinderella-type image, if you will.
Sheena Rossiter, thank you. That was Sheena Rossiter, Monocle's woman in Rio. Up next, we'll be looking at a new addition to the architectural and cultural landscape of Spain. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House.
Thinking of starting your own business? Want to make your company a better place to work? Keen to sharpen those ambitions? Or just like some nicer business cards? Well, we know a handsome primer that will take you from fledgling firm to established brand. The new Monocle Guide to Good Business is a 300-page plus book packed with inspirational stories, wise advice, places to locate your new HQ, and of course, great photography and illustrations too. Head to monocle.com to order your copy now or visit any of our stores. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is a book that will show you how to do a job you really love, create a modest dynasty, use your hands and your brain, and even take your dog to work. Come on, it's time for a change.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. It's 1841 here in London. No Spanish city needs to be persuaded of the transformative possibilities of a bold new art gallery, at least not since the Frank Gehry-designed Guggenheim opened in Bilbao 17 years ago. About 60 miles to the west of Bilbao, Santander has similar hopes for its Centro Botín, a creation by Italian architect Renzo Piano, taking shape on the city's shoreline due to open next year and funded by Emilio Botín III, the current president of Santander Bank. Well, joining me now with more on this is Inigo Sáenz de Miera Cardenas, who's the general manager of the Botín Foundation. I mentioned there the Guggenheim in Bilbao. How much was that an inspiration to this project?
Hello, Andrew. Thank you very much. Well, not much, being honest, no, because the facts are very different. The Botín Foundation has been working already for 50 years in the international art landscape, no, since Guggenheim was something coming to Bilbao from abroad, no. So, in some sense, this is an organic development of the Botín Foundation, no. The Botín Foundation is already 50 years old. We run an important art program, another educational one, and the Botín Center is something that we do to integrate, to join the art program and the educational one in something which is going to be really new, which is an art center, but also an educational center, which will use the arts to improve the creativity, developing the social and emotional intelligence. So it's quite different. The cities are similar, that's true. We are both in the north of Spain. We have a wonderful relationship with the Guggenheim, but I think it's different. Santander and Bilbao also are very different cities.
The Centro Botín is still a work in progress. I know it's not necessarily an easy thing to describe a building, but can you give us some sense of what it might look like when it's finished?
Well, the first thing is that you have to imagine, if people can go and see Google Earth, maybe Santander. Santander has one of the bays, one of the most beautiful bays in the world. It's true that being me, the one who says that, maybe it's not that easy to believe me, but please believe me. And the Botín Center is going to be like a link between the historical gardens of Santander, the Pereda Gardens, and the bay. So it's going to be between the bay and the city, and it's going to be like a new place of encounter, unifying gardens and the bay, and trying to become a place to fertilize the city life through arts. So it's a garden. We want to build a garden. We, in fact, opened already a part of the gardens in July. We have been all the month running activities, cultural, artistic, and social activities in the gardens. So imagine something in the middle of a garden but facing a bay. No, it's even over the bay. No, it flies somehow over the bay, and it flies also over the land, so you can in every moment feel the horizon of the bay. No, so it's something very magic. It's something very special. I think that we choose Renzo Piano just because that. No, because he's a master in generating new areas, playing with land and sea.
Now, pleasant as though all that sounds, it hasn't been universally welcomed in Santander. There's been various court cases, various complaints about it. The people who object to the building, what is their issue with it?
Well, you know, it's almost impossible to do something which is important and 100% of the people to coincide and to have the same opinion, no? It's wonderful. We all have different opinions. But I have to tell you that, I mean, the in July we opened the gardens. As you say, the building is going on. We had 700 volunteers. We had 20,000 people participating in the gardens, 3,000 people going to a concert. No one was complaining. It is true that there are some people that thought that and think that this building could be in another place, not that it would be better to let the landscape as it was. But I'm sure you cannot remember an important architectural building or an important building in the city which hasn't any complaint by anyone. And in fact, this is something very important. Renzo Piano is wonderful at listening. This is something that I admire the most from him, no? And the project has changed so much from the beginning from to today, because many of the ideas that were arising in the multiple debates that we had and in the social debate that has happened in the last 3 years, that we changed a lot. We changed even the location. We built a tunnel, no, a new tunnel, 220 meters long tunnel, to double the surface of the gardens. And I think that now, because this social debate, the center is much better than it was.
Inigo Sáenz de Miera Cardenas, the General Manager of the Botín Foundation, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's time now for some music. In a moment, we'll be heading to Vienna to talk Austrian art to get us in the mood. Austria's own Parov Stella with The Sun. Parov Stella with The Sun. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres. Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle 26.
From London,
London,
Caracas. This is Monocle 24. 18:51 in London, coming up to the end of our show, which is time to review the best and, when the occasion demands it, the worst in the worlds of the arts. And today we are talking art, that is, of the visual variety. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco caught up with our Berlin correspondent Kimberly Bradley. She's reviewing the best exhibitions from Vienna, and she starts telling us about Carsten Holler's new exhibition at TBA 21.
Hi, Ken. Good to have you here. We're going to do an art review from Vienna, which I believe you've been there recently. And where shall we start?
TBA 21, which is an exhibition space that's run by Francesca von Habsburg. And she is one of the major patrons in the world. And she opened the space 2-3 years ago, and it's in the Augarten Park. And this summer, she's had a show that goes actually till mid-October or so, and it's called Leben by Carsten Huller.
And how does it look like? I believe there's some oversized bird cages there.
There's a lot of stuff in there. That's actually not the most spectacular thing. Huller is actually pretty famous. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's a Belgian-born German artist, or of German lineage, who kind of considers himself Belgian. And anyone who was in the Tate recently would know his giant slides. And in Germany, he recently had a show where he had 12 reindeer taking hallucinogenics living in a huge museum. So he deals a lot with kind of playful things and somewhat childlike things, but he always has a strange twist. And in this show, he's got, it's a series of rooms, and each room pretty much just has one work. And the centerpiece of the whole show is a large hotel bed called elevator bed. It's on some sort of lift. And the interesting thing is that any visitor who wants to, they can book this through the Sofitel, can sleep in the bed overnight in the exhibition space. And so the experience of being in an exhibition space and amongst art can be a longer one. In the room next to that is a tower that you climb through a spiral staircase, and at the top of the tower is an immersion tank. Another room has two really oversized bird cages, huge. Each of them is maybe 3 meters tall, and they're birds a very rare breed singing to each other. There are two or three video works, and then outside on the grounds in the park are oversized mushrooms. This is a bit of a hearkening back to one of his older works too, where he was dealing with hallucinogenics.
Moving on to another exhibition, which I quite like the title, New Ways of Doing Nothing.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit more about this exhibition?
That New Ways of Doing Nothing is a group show at the Kunsthalle Wien. Kunsthalle in German is a museum, but one that does not have a permanent collection. And that allows for a lot of experimentation. They have rotating shows. They have a brand new curator. I think he's been there for a little less than a year, Nicholas Schaffhausen. And this show explores just exactly what it says, new ways of doing nothing, partially because we live in this super neoliberal world where everybody always has to feel super productive. Yet, a bunch of philosophers in the past, like Roland Barthes, have dealt with, you know, what are the virtues of laziness? And so some of the artists that are in the show deal with this, like Ryan Gander and Superflex. There are video works, there's some sculptures. Some of the sculptures are just chairs on wheels that you can push around. Very slow videos that just barely change, so the visitor is forced to stand and do nothing. In the show, the lights are very dim. And we, my partner, who's also an Austrian artist, we were looking at this and we decided that doing nothing means black and white, because I don't think there's a stitch of color in the entire exhibition.
Oh, interesting. And let's continue at the Kunsthalle. There's another at the project space. They have a very interesting thing, a glass cube on Karlsplatz.
They've had that for quite some time. It's a bit like a Mies van der Rohe building. But since Nicholas has taken over the Kunsthalle, they've shifted things around there a little bit. But the show that's been in there over the summer and will remain for a bit is called the Brancusi Effect. It's a whole scat of sculptures by lots of different artists that deal with the pillars that Brancusi used, the Romanian artist who's very famous for his clarity of form. And you've got people, I mean, he actually, what's interesting is he uses several architects in the show, like Jürgen Meyer H. from Berlin, and a young artist called Ante Liu, who's a Chinese-Canadian. And they're different. The one piece, for example, is just a stack of garbage buckets. There are some very simple pillars. And what's great is that as you're driving through Karlsplatz, even from your car, you get this little blast of these forms as you pass by. It's a little bit like a fishbowl. You can look at it from the outside. In fact, I never got the chance to see the show from the inside, but I've seen it several times from the outside, just kind of gazing on it.
And Kina, I just want to ask you, so we were talking before, I mean, that's all great exhibitions you just mentioned, but there's some sort of a transition in the visual art world in Vienna. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah,
why is that?
It's a bit difficult to say where things are going. I keep mentioning the Kunsthalle, and Nicholas Schaffhausen, for example, is a relatively new curator, and he is shaking things up there. He is German. I mean, sometimes Austrians complain a little bit that there's a German guy and he's putting German people in his shows. But I think he's added some new energy to the city at the same time as two of the major foundations that did exhibitions have left. Both the Generali Foundation And the Bavag Foundation, where some of the edgiest shows in Vienna often took place in the past few years, have disappeared. I think the Bavag is completely gone, and don't quote me on that completely, but I think it is. And the Generali has moved to Salzburg. And so a lot of people are seeing a little bit of a gap, wondering what's going to happen. The Vienna Art Fair got a new owner 2 years ago, and then yet another new owner last year. It has a focus on Eastern European art, but it's not super successful quite yet. The gallery scene is as strong as it ever was, but it's still small. And so people are kind of looking at Vienna and wondering what the next steps are.
Well, we might need another update from you very soon. Thank you very much, Kim.
It's Kimberly Bradley talking to the latest openings in, talking through rather, latest openings in Vienna with our Fernando Augusto Pacheco. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And that is all we have time for on today's edition. My thanks in particular to our earlier guests, Samira Shackle and Nina Schick. Today's show was produced by Phil Hahn, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Rebecca Unger. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. Next up, after the headlines, we have The Culture Show with Robert Bound at 2200 London time. I'll be back for the Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow. It's 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.